I'm going to talk about humans, I mean human animals. I'm not drawing a strong distinction between them, but of course we do talk about humanity, and it is such a driver that we're always triangulating with these two other concepts. When we attempt to articulate or re-articulate what any one of these things meet, it's like they're kind of attached by rubber bands, and the other two will shift with it. And it's a very old triangulation. We could push it back to Descartes, who of course was thinking about animals, machines, and humans the whole time. And we can take it right the way forward to, of course, people like Don Haraway, who have tried to re-articulate, to reconfigure those by reclaiming and constituting a cyborg. And these images that she worked with the artist Liv Randolph to produce capture that three-way triangulation very beautifully. An ant, I would claim, therefore, is partly made of ideas about humans and machines. It's not a thing in itself. But the problem is that we do think an ant is an actual thing. But what I'm suggesting today, it's not an actual thing. It's a thing that is also composed of those fragmented categories of humanity and of mechanism that are constantly recombining in complex and promiscuous ways. And we need to therefore be especially careful when we use ants to think about humanity. We need to be careful, and we need to be aware that we've already made some of those recombinations of humanity into ants within the first place. An ant is not a unitary, singular, coherent thing, even within science itself. How do you throw a quadrat around an ant? What is the thing? It's always interesting to me, what kinds of animals do we give common names to? Sometimes the quadrat of the common name will go around a single species, and other times it goes around a clump of animals that seem like a natural category to us. Frogs and toads is a sort of a really interesting and intriguing example of that. What makes an animal category, and under what conditions do we grant it an ology? That's a really interesting question as well. So ants get myrmecology, but there's no ratology, for example. A rat is a thing that can figure in numerous scientific systems, whereas early in the 20th century, people who thought ants were really cool worked really hard to make them worthy of an ology. So here are a number of ways in which ants have been studied, a number of epistemologies through which they've been studied. We don't need to think about these in any detail now, but I just want to flag up that, you know, what counts as an ant, and reciprocally how we study it, is always reconfiguring what an ant is. So where shall we date this conflation of ants and machines in particular back to? A good place to start might be with Carol Čapek's play R.U.R. in the 1920s, a really, really interesting piece of writing, Rossum's Universal Robots. So if you know your sci-fi at all, this is famous as the thing that introduced the word robot into the English language. In Czech it means a drone, a worker. And it's a super interesting play. You should all go away and read it. And one way of reading it is actually a play about animal rights, not about metallic creatures at all. And Čapek was always very cross that people so quickly sort of started drawing robots as metal things. He said, that's not what I meant at all. They're biological organisms. So that's really interesting. In general, at the beginning of the modernist era, ants were seen as the very opposite of what humans could or should aspire to be. And here is the man who, in the 1920s and 30s, really put the antithesis into ants. An American called William Morton Wheeler, he was part of a move towards a sociological understanding of ant behaviour. Unlike 19th century researchers, he was not terribly interested in the psychological individual capacities of ants. So here's one of those moments where the quadrat shifts and you're capturing something different about what ants are. What interested him was the way that they work together to produce an emergent whole, a superorganism, that's his term, that acted as a single being. He was very much involved in conversations with sociologists, and we can very much place his work in the context of the fear of mass culture that was prevalent in Europe and the US in the 1920s. But it has to be said, the machine wasn't an obvious element of his discourse. You could arguably say that it was present in the background, the Fordist factories, industrialized warfare, even gramophone, cinema, radio. But it was, it's not very obviously present in what he wrote. Probably a better starting point to talk about ants and machines being conflated would be the 1940s and the birth of cybernetics and communication theory. Fact of the day, Norbert Wiener's very first published scientific paper was about ants, but he went on to find fame with his theory of cybernetics, which went on to generate a lot of very important military research about how networks behave, how communication can be achieved. E.O. Wilson, the very famous myrmecologist, can be placed within this explosion. Wilson, such an interesting man, we'll come back to him again later. He was very, very self-consciously on the lookout for what will be the big new biological theory and how can I make the ants play into that. And he very astutely picked up on this communication theory that was developing. And sociobiology is, if you look at it, it's the kind of socio bit is sort of a little bit of a misleading word. When he started articulating it, he was talking about it as a theory of communication that would be the way of understanding the animal kingdom as a whole. So at some point in this post-cybernetics era, ants stopped being those sort of modernist bogeys, you know, oh my goodness, we should be really careful, otherwise we'll turn into an ant society. And they became a useful model. They became a tool for intelligent problem solving. If we look at ants, we can create tools that solve our problems. And so one of the most famous examples of this that is cited is the so-called traveling salesman problem. Now, do I need to explain this? Do you know it? Put your hand up if you know about this. No, okay, right. So here's a map of France, and there's a man with a case of Beaujolais, and he's got to drop it off at all the major cities in France. What's going to be the most efficient route that he can choose? What's going to be the shortest route that he can choose? This turns out to be mind-bogglingly difficult for a computer to calculate, but you can kind of use an ant model to calculate it. So imagine you set a train of ants going. The paths will be strengthened by the pheromone trails that they leave behind. So just by a sort of a process of natural selection, they will improve. They will shorten the path. It may not be the shortest path, in the same way that evolution might not come up with the best solution, but it will be good enough. So there's a little animation here to watch. It's very quick. So I haven't looked at it, but here's the brightness. This whole show could be slipper. So here's ant one, there's the path it takes. Ant two, as they travel, they're laying down these pheromone maps, and the optimal solution is emerging on the right-hand side, right? Starting again, running it again. So the path is gradually shortening on the right-hand side as they lay down their trails. Don't worry, there won't be a test. So telephone networks, delivery networks, it's all about the transfer of information and efficiency. And then about once every year or two, we see the same news story being flagged as new again. And it's about the idea that scientists have created a robot ant colony. And this story has, well, I started writing about ants sort of in the early 2000s, and it was coming up then, and it's still coming up. The one on the one that's on top here is a 2014 story. Let's watch a little video. And the video goes on to show them making things, kind of gluing things together, making very intricate, tiny little devices, quite intriguing. I just think it's kind of worth pausing on this so-called news story that is a news story about once every year. It reminds me of Victorian writing about insects, where you always, especially with ants, you always get the reference to Proverbs in the Bible and what Solomon says about the ant. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, because they know her ways and be wise. And it strikes me that this story kind of fulfills that little function in our society. So it's really worth pausing and asking, what is it reconfirming for us? Because it's doing some very important cultural work. And by the end, we might maybe have some answers towards that. So what I want to do for the rest of this talk is to bring you right up to date with the latest thinking about ants and how that is configured with the machine. I suppose we could, if you like, you could call this talk Ant 2.0. What is the latest ant science? How have we constructed ants through our ant machine analogies in the age of the internet? And how have these changes redounded in the sphere of humanity? The argument I want to move towards is that, looking at the story, we still have a very externalized idea of ants and machines, and that thinking about the internet, we really need to internalize that a bit more, that there's some kind of unwarranted confidence about the uniqueness of humanity that we've got through not working through fully. Right, so this next section of the talk then is going to be about some recent changes in myrmecology, the science of ants. And I want to start by talking about these two people. So E.O. Wilson on the right, whom I've already mentioned, the person who used his ants to build up the theory of sociobiology. And then on the left, somebody you probably haven't heard of, Deborah Gordon. When I wrote my first book about ants in 2003, The final chapter was about a debate that was then ongoing and open between these two. And they're such rich pickings to understand the story. So two very, very different characters, two very, very different histories. So E.O. Wilson, the grand old man of biology. If you read his biography, he really plays up the very Victorian gung-ho adventures that he had in seeking after the ants. His is a multi-species account. He's interested in lots of different kinds of ants and lots of other kinds of animals. For him, ants are fundamentally belligerent creatures, and he uses them to build a big theory. Gordon, very different story. She spent her whole career on a single patch of ground in the Arizona desert, looking at a single species of ant. So it's a really deep, deep study of a single species. And for her, ants are not fundamentally belligerent. When she looks at her ants, she sees a fundamental cooperativeness. And I think there's a question mark over, is she trying to construct a big theory in the way that Wilson has? Not sure. Deborah Gordon did a very cheeky thing when she reviewed Wilson's book Journey to the Ants in 1994. She said, Holzoppler and Wilson have done for ants what Levi's did for denim. And the book's publishers thought this was really great and they put it on the back cover. And I'm not sure that it was intended as a straightforward compliment. It keys into notions of popularization and accessibility, but when you read on through the rest of the review, a different set of connotations emerges: uniformity, the ruthlessness associated with global capitalist domination. She went on to write, the ants and Journey to the Ants always know exactly what they're doing. They do not mess around. Their duties and their destinies are clear. Destiny is a word that Wilson uses about himself in his autobiography. Relentless and fanatical, they're self-sacrificing minions programmed to act in concert. Gangs of factory workers whose loyalty is nearly total. They are led into servitude by the inexorable hand of natural selection. This gives us a hint as to what Gordon's view about ants is. You can kind of read the negatives into it, but in particular she's interested in behavioural flexibility. The ability to respond to immediate circumstances, but also the way that the character of the nest changes as it ages. So the nest itself has a character that matures, kind of has a teenage phase where it's a bit elbowy, and then it kind of grows up and chills out a little bit. At the time when I wrote that book in 2003, Gordon was very much the underdog. But earlier this year, I was invited to participate in a round table at the International Union for the Study of Social Insects. And much to my kind of excitement, I discovered that what I can really only call a paradigm shift had taken place, and that Gordon is now more or less regarded as where it's at. So some very interesting new models have emerged in a very short space of time as a way of thinking about what ants are and how they do it. So I want to briefly review these three models of thinking about ant 2.0. They're epigenetics, individual processes, and last of all, metadata. We'll spend the most time on that one. Epigenetics is all the rage in current biology, as I'm sure you know. Broadly, it fits in with our sort of more mushy notions of information that we're developing at present. In the olden days, computers were programmed to do something, and they did it. They were rigid. Even with the idea of software, the software was still a program. To future generations, maybe even to current ones, all this talk about computers will seem very antiquated. Epigenetics, if you like, is the Apple of DNA. Genes are not hardwired programs, they're apps. They can be turned on and off. They can even be predisposed to turn on and off in future generations. The programming, if you insist on calling it that, is distributed between different devices, between bodies and environmental cues. In social entomology, however, epigenetics has been invoked in a fairly limited sense to talk about how different castes are created. So I think that's a very interesting narrow focusing of what epigenetics is. It doesn't trouble the understanding of what castes are or how they act. And Gordon herself is quite dismissive of epigenetics and its relevance for her, which in some senses is no surprise, especially when you look at the big history of myrmecology. Myrmecologists, along with other animal biologists, fought long and hard in the 20th century to sort of say, no, our work is important, it's not just molecular. You know, as the whole molecular bandwagon gathered momentum, it was difficult for them. Wilson, in particular, his career was really, really challenging because the whole time at Harvard there was this sense of molecular is the only place it's at, and to say, no, looking at animals is important was a difficult thing. I want to turn to this very cool woman who's kind of carrying forward a second strand in Anne's at the moment. She's a comparative psychologist and ethologist based at Novosibirsk State University in Siberia. Her geographical location is, I think, significant, and she certainly makes a play of it. Although in the past 5 or 10 years, communication has, of course, become easier, the bulk of her research life was conducted at a time and in a culture where travel and discussion was difficult. And she portrays herself as kind of detached from the squabbles in Europe and the US. She claims to integrate traditions which have been seen as antagonistic. She also accounts for her research by a remarkable jump cut in the history of science. She says it was reading a copy of the Victorian book by John Lubbock, Ants, Bees and Wasps, that got her interested in the creature. So it's like there was a kind of a big chunk missing. Her work is indeed a direct descendant of those Victorian traditions in that she focuses on individual psychological capacities. Based on the ideas of sociobiology, Reznikova raises an intriguing problem of whether there's room for intelligence within the framework of social specialization in animal communities. She works with many different kinds of animal, but ants seem to be her favorite. Here's one of her experiments. So this is a maze. And each of the orange arrows is a kind of a choice point where you have to go down, where the ant has to go down one corridor or another. And randomly, at the end of one of these 8 paths, is some food for the ants. So the question is, can the ants learn the maze, and can the ants pass the information on to naive ants to complete the maze? This, she says, is an informational transfer whose content can be measured. It's a binary code, she says. The same code as computers use. At each point, it's a 1 or a 0, a left or a right. A maze with 3 branches, like this one, has 2 choices at the first branch, 2 times 2 at the next, 2 times 2 times 2 at the third. So that's 8 bits of information altogether, the same as the number of possible endpoints. Well, she proves to her own satisfaction that the information is being passed on, because ants, if you let one ant run the maze successfully and then you let it talk to another ant, that next ant will complete the maze quicker than a naive ant. And you obviously do that lots of times to get the statistical certainty. Then she asks, how much longer do the ants spend in that antennal contact for a longer maze than for a shorter one? So she runs these mazes up to 6 branches, which is really, really long and complicated. And indeed she finds that the longer the maze, the more time they spend in antennal contact, taking the ones that do it successfully. Finally, she asks a really, really interesting question. This is the really mind-blowing one. Are data strings compressed if there's a pattern? So for example, if I was directing you to this one, I wouldn't say right, then right, then right. I would say go right 3 times. Or in another place I'd say go, just keep going left, then right. You'll get there. I don't need to spell out left, right, left, right, left, right. My question is, do ants compress? So these are the sequences that she asked them to run. and she measures the duration of the antennal contact time that they spend. And I turned this into a graph because it wasn't very clear on the table. So here's the path getting more and more complicated. When there is a pattern, like left, right, or left, the length of time that it takes to communicate that goes up more slowly than when there's no pattern. It looks like ants do compress data. I just wanted to show you that because it's so cool, really. In other experiments, Reznikov claims ants can use cognitive maps, they can learn by observation, and that they can even count. But the big news that I want to emphasize here is that it's not an investigation of social level behavior, but of individuals, and we'll skip over that for time. My sense is that this is very old-fashioned, and I'd be really surprised Reznikova's work becomes the dominant model for myrmecology. But hey, I could be really surprised. That would be great. I'm not saying it's wrong, not that there's anything wrong with her science. It's just not very of the moment. It's sort of Lubbock plus the travelling salesman. Gordon's latest research, by contrast, is supremely of the moment. And if you've been waiting for Edward Snowden, don't worry, he's going to be along very shortly. Gordon continues to develop her model for how ants can behave flexibly and how the nest itself can behave flexibly. So the question that she asks herself is, an ant's response to a chemical cue was not fixed, but depended on what the ant was doing. And what determined what the ant was doing? So I should kind of fill you in on the straw man here. So the sort of the naive idea is that there is a chemical that says, go forage now, or go pick up the dead body from the edge of the nest, or go fight now. But there is a single chemical that says that. But under certain circumstances, and indeed it was Wilson who pointed this out, that the chemical that does that thing doesn't do that thing. So that's what she's talking about. The response to the chemical cue is not fixed. Sometimes it doesn't work. What determines what the ant is doing? And this is the answer that she has now clarified in her later publications. It's the pattern of contact itself rather than any particular message. How an ant behaves, what task it does at any given time, depends in part on the pheromones it tastes through antennal contact. But, as Gordon also finds, it depends on the intensity of that tasting, on the frequency of that tasting, and the time frame containing that frequency. So how strong, how many molecules of the chemical there are, how many times they're encountered, and the intensity of the timing of that. So to take a human comparison, if I show you a really loud or dazzling advertisement for a car, that's the intensity. If I show it to you twice, that's the frequency. And if I show it to you twice in the same ad break, that's the time frame before you forget that you saw it before. So here's how she translates it in the mind of ants. If I meet another ant with odor A about 3 times in the next 30 seconds, I will go out to forage. If not, I will stay here. Or, to put it even more precisely, if I meet another ant with odor A about 3 times in the next 30 seconds, the probability that I will go out to forage will increase by about 10%. If not, it will go down by about 20%. In other words, Gordon's research is about something we've been hearing a lot about recently. It's metadata. Metadata is data about data. Data is what I said in the email to my boss. I'm sorry, I won't be able to attend tomorrow's staff meeting, as I have a terrible bug and I've gone to the doctors. That's the data. The metadata is the time I sent that email, the number of times I've previously emailed my boss, the device of origin, let's say my phone, might also include the GPS location of my phone at the time I sent the message, which if you choose to look at it, might reveal I was actually at the beach, which is Todd Snowden explains. Metadata is contrasted typically against content. People think about metadata being the details of the call. When you made the call, who the call was to, when it happened, how long it occurred for, versus the content of the call, which is what you said. As an analyst, nine times out of ten, you don't care what was said on the phone call until very late in the investigative chain. What you care about is the metadata, because the metadata does not lie. And he goes on to explain how this is useful in real life, basically the terrorist's equivalent of me lying on the phone. Right, so beginning to join up now metadata and ants. I have a question for you, which is, do you live in a nest? This is a photograph from a weekend magazine, and you may have seen these on billboards. Nest was launched in 2011. It's a thermostat that learns the patterns of your heating use and regulates it accordingly. An add-on followed swiftly, a smoke detector that networked with the thermostat and your mobile phone. The original Nest was developed in the southern states, where the issue is keeping cool rather than keeping warm. The trouble is, this area is also prone to brownouts. Now, there's a whole economic story that you can tell about brownouts. If you've seen the film Enron, you'll know about that. But there's no time for that. A large part of the marketing blah for Nest was therefore about how it helps to solve the electricity problems of the network. By aggregating data, learning patterns of use, and spreading aircon fire ups so they didn't all come on at once and overload the system. Your Nest is your home, and on another level, it's the human colony. And Al Gore was amongst those to give it the thumbs up. What goes for cold goes for hot, and now Nest is available in this country. The original product cost $250, but Nest is now offered as a freebie extra if you sign up to N-Power Electricity. Perhaps some of you already live in a Nest. In January this year, Nest was bought for $3.2 billion. Not bad for a thermostat. And guess who bought it? Google. Wired magazine explains. How about value of the devices, in a sense, lies not in the hardware itself, but in the interconnectedness of that hardware. As the devices talk to each other, by building an aggregate picture of human behavior, they anticipate what we want before we even know. Google already knows what we search for on the web, but it can now also track us through the trails we leave behind us in the Internet of Things, our phones. Let's say, thanks to an interface with Nest, when we came home. But don't worry. Google has said that the data about Nest customers will not be shared with other marketers. Our privacy policy clearly limits the use of customer information to providing and improving Nest's products and services. We've always taken privacy seriously. It's not changed. But here's the thing about metadata. One way to think about it is the difference between denoting and connoting. Reznikova was quite correct to this extent. We don't need to know what the message means. We just need to be part of the system that vindicates it through yielding profit. Some people gloat that they can somehow confound their store loyalty card by buying fancy olive oil and basic toilet rolls, so that the loyalty system card doesn't know what to make of them. This is a category error, and a solipsistic one at that. The loyalty card has no concept of you. It simply has a set of algorithms that can predict with reasonable confidence that a person who bought basic toilet paper in the last 6 months has a higher than average chance of buying basic kitchen roll too. That's enough. So going back to our previous slide, here's what the ant decides. If I buy cheap toilet paper about 3 times in the next 30 weeks, the probability that I will buy cheap kitchen roll will increase by about 10%. If not, it will go down by about 10%, 20%. Here's another example. Let's imagine that the University of Ashford is exploring ways to improve attendance monitoring. Again, there's a hidden story here. You may know about immigration. Again, we'll park it. They discover that you can buy a gadget that you put outside the lecture room and that students just have to bip their ID cards on it when they come in. The gadget is made by a startup that's quickly bought out by Google. Google can, if it chooses, figure out exactly who's in the room now and market to them directly. 10p off a cup of coffee in the 10 minutes when you come out of the room. Half-price energy drink in the 10 minutes before you go into the room. But they may make a gentleman's agreement not to do this, as they did with Nest. In this case, they can still do connotative marketing using their metadata. Even if it's not pinned to the precise person, they still have metadata on what lecture slots are best populated, how many cups of coffee are bought before and after it, and so on. The metadata will do nicely once your phone has put you in the right zone. You are not you. You're a node on the network that will as like as not respond, or is more likely to respond by some precious percentage margin. To switch animal metaphors, there is no spider in the middle of the web. Not at Ashford, not at Google, maybe not even in the CIA, not really, not just looking at you and you and you. There's no one scrutinizing all the data, only the metadata. There's no one planning all of this. The interactions produce the behavior of individuals and hence the Nest. As Gordon says, the network is not a hidden program. And the Nest, developing and changing, supervenes in a looping fashion back on its individuals. Exactly the changing character of the Nest. The metadata we have to worry about is the metadata that the advertisers and the marketers have. It's not personal, and that's the whole problem. So far as their metadata goes, you are not you. You're a component of an economic system, advertising and consumption, and that works very nicely, thank you. Having spent some time looking at these latest models for understanding ant behaviour and focusing on metadata in particular, I want to spend the final section of this talk evaluating what it means to consider ants as participants in a system of metadata. I've got a whole section that I'm going to skip, which is really about the history of the metaphor. And I'll just summarise it by saying, I'm kind of, on some level, uncomfortable by how perfect the fit is between this latest thinking about ants and metadata. As a historian of science, I'm trained as an externalist, that's to look for cultural conditions that make science, scientists behave the way it does. And this is just, it's too good to be true. And also there's a timing issue here. Gordon's last book about ants was published in 2010. She doesn't actually use the word metadata, but it's so irresistible to see it as metadata, the pattern of contact. I can't really work it out. I don't think we were using the word metadata in 2010, but how can you have the idea from when you had the idea? So there's problems there, or challenges. But let's skip over that, and we'll just talk about the cultural implications to finish. Of metadata, them and us. I wondered, back in 2003, why Deborah Gordon started her first book with the canard that ants have no overseer. I was even more surprised when she did it again for her latest book. Surely there's no one left who seriously thinks that the ants queen manages the nest, is there? But this is the line in the sand, in the kind of Arizona desert sand, that she draws over and over again, the difference between ants and humans. But ants, I'll come on to that in a sec. To understand the line that she draws, we need to pause for a moment and look at the comparison that she uses to set up her latest book. And she describes how she took her son to go and watch an event that was happening not so far away from him. It's the DARPA Challenge. Also because it figures so large in Gordon's mind. people.
We have the green flag. The event is started. Launch the bot.
In 2001, Congress mandated that by 2015, one-third of the operational combat ground vehicles should be unmanned. Congress authorized the Defense Department and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA, to award cash prizes as a means of recognizing outstanding achievements in defense-related research and development.
Look at this, it's amazing. On the MIT steering wheel. And we can tell you that Talos is now beginning its second mission.
When you're looking at the amount of data that they have to crunch to be able to sift things out and make decisions, it's really hard to keep things simple. The tendency is going to be to put more sensors, more computers, funnel in more data.
Hi, I'm Chad Vanderveen. 2007 marks the third of the DARPA Grand Challenge events for
Okay, so these are autonomous vehicles, and the challenge is for them to get around a track, complete certain challenges, and get to the end. It's a great public event. Just skip on to see how the vehicles actually behave.
And successfully relaunched. There were a number of groundbreaking events over the course of the day. The dreaded bot meets bot went off without incident, but then...
And it looks like we may have a bot in distress, trying to figure out whether or not it'll be able to sense and back up to get back on course, the 26th vehicle.
Wow.
And Talos is going to pass.
Very aggressive.
Whoa! Oh, we had our first collision. Crash in turn one.
Yeah, that's exactly where you wouldn't want to be hit, is right in your sensor package. Here comes, it looks like, little Ben approaching.
See, now what do we do? Okay, folks, we have got our first autonomous traffic jam.
Another historic event right here.
Uh-oh. It looks like Terramax came awfully close to basically taking a pillar and replacing it.
Despite these occurrences, the race unfolded with remarkable smoothness, with 6 of the 11 bots completing all 19 submissions within the 3 major missions. Organizers and observers were constantly struck by the seemingly human behavior of the autonomous robotic vehicles.
I'm sorry, I can't help but give human qualities to an inanimate object.
To see a car with nobody operating it, it's bizarre.
You look at the vehicle and there you go, an empty seat.
Well, yeah, and I think it's the behavior of the vehicle is so human-like that you start to forget that it is a machine that is making its own decisions.
The last bot.
Okay. So this is what Gordon has in her mind when she's thinking about the difference between ants and humans. One way that living systems are unique, so obvious that it's easy to forget, is that they cause their own development and activity. For example, basic difference between a collection of robots and an ant colony is that people make the robots, while ant colonies are made by other ant colonies. Human designers are behind everything a robot does. In an ant colony, there's nobody behind anything. In an ant colony, a forager can change its mission. The robotic vehicles in the DARPA challenge interaction could not change the mission. There's been some really important slippage here. Gordon says the internet is a network built up of all our emails and so on. She says ants participate in such a network, but then she distinguishes ants from humans by comparing ants not to our internet, but to a network of robots. The internet, as I hope I've already indicated, is not a collection of robots, but something much more profoundly self-organizing and self-perpetuating As algorithms feed back data about consumption, better algorithms are created. Gordon has shied away from the full implications of her insights by restricting the human comparison. Not that it's her job, by the way, to make human comparisons. But it's interesting. But if we look at a range of scholars within the social sciences and humanities, we start to see why Gordon's distinction may be untenable. So Mary Douglas is not a bad place to start on how institutions think. Half of our task as social scientists is to demonstrate the cognitive process at the foundation for social order. The other half of our task is to demonstrate that the individual's most elementary cognitive process depends on social institutions. So again, it's this looping structure. The earliest scholarship on these kinds of processes didn't deal specifically with machines, or did it? Here's Bauman on modernity, and he talks about adiaphorization. The principal tool of severance was and remains adiaphorization, making certain actions, or certain objects of action, morally neutral or irrelevant, exempt from categories of phenomena suitable for moral evaluation. It's about externalization. The effect of adiaphorization is achieved by excluding some categories of people, things, animals, machines, from the realm of moral subjects, or through covering up the link between partial action and the ultimate effect of coordinating moves, or through enthroning procedural discipline and personal loyalty in the role of the all-overriding criterion of moral performance. It's a description of modernity that resonates, for example, with Weber. And of course, it's a description of some of the most horrible events of the 20th century and beyond. But it's also very suggestive, I think, of computerization, especially in that phrase, through covering up the link between partial action and the ultimate effect of coordinated moves. It's the externalization of our collective decisions. They're black boxing, or better yet, they're beige boxing, the computer. The computer as an artifact has become a way of externalizing those decisions, of reifying adiaphorization in the machine. It's perfectly characterized. How much time? I've got another page to go. Should we watch a funny thing? So some of you may know this is a British comedy series that started out on the radio and then transferred to TV, and it ultimately became quite crude, but initially it was quite incisive. Well, this is a theme. The computer says no. It's one of many sketches which the computer says no.
It all happened so fast. I was knocked to the ground, and when I came to, my handbag with my purse and my credit cards had all gone. I've just come from the hospital. I need to pay my gas bill, and I've got to buy a present for my grandson. I just don't know what to do.
We better get you some new ones, haven't we? Computer says no.
So the sketch is funny in its claim that the computer says no, because the human staff have so completely disengaged from the process, disinvested from a relationship with the woman whose bag's been stolen, exemplified by the inappropriate body language, the coughing in the face, and so on. The humans are saying no, but they're claiming it's the machine. And I would suggest that we have perpetuated this externalization, this black boxing of what human choices are in the way we're currently thinking about ants as machines rather than ants and internets. Having externalized the ant as a machine, we're happy to do what the 20th century people were not, that is to think like ants, because we think it's not us, but our tool that is thinking like ants, or so we believe. Another person that we could use to think more dangerously about the kind of networks that we're creating is Sheila Jasanoff, who you may have come across. For Jasanoff, technical and social systems are co-productive, locked in a cycle, change and reinforcement. She actually has surprisingly little to say about the internet, but here is all going. Millions of people began to alter not only the architecture of the internet, but also in diverse ways their own preconceptions of what it means to belong to social units. And here's, again, Gordon's phrase, the sum of their interactions. So it's a much more looping thing. The network, in other words, contrary to what Gordon says, is constantly redefining the mission. Gordon's perspective, the metadata is constantly redefining the task of the participants, which or who in turn generate fresh metadata. From the perspective of the network, it's more ontologically profound. They, that is we, become metadata. Once you're in a system of metadata, you are metadata. The internet as a system of metadata draws us back into the precarious externalization of the animal and machine, the ant and the robot that marked the 20th century. Only by disintegrating the ant and the internet can we reintegrate ourselves as humans.
Sorry, I went on a bit there.
No, don't worry, but you started a little late as well, so it doesn't matter.